Chapter 7, A Reincarnation. In the course of David Frost's one-day holiday in Ibiza, he checked up that John and I had actually been doing some writing, and even squawked at it, which we took for laughter, but he pointedly looked forward to reading more than 10 pages, and said that he thought it would be a good idea if John Cleese, Tim Brooke Taylor, Marty Feldman, and myself did a TV comedy show together, and added that he was looking for something for Ronnie Corbett to do, remarking, "Perhaps you, Graham, and Barry Cryer would like to have a go at writing it, a kind of middle-class situation comedy. There hasn't really been one." That all sounded very good to me, although I knew him. I'd never written with Barry before. How would it be if Eric Idle and Barry and myself were to write a programme for the series? "Super," said David, "super," and went off to frolic in the shallow waters. And so, what was to become The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, later rewritten with Peter Cook, and At Last the 1948 Show, very much a progenitor of Python, and several series of Ronnie Corbett's No That's Me Over Here, would never have happened if it hadn't been for 45 minutes of David Frost's enthusiasm and confidence prior to paddling. Between the first run of 7 and the second of 6 1948 shows, I was living with David in a flat in Hampstead. The coming out party. 22 Gayton Crescent, 1960 thing. "Bring, bring," said the telephone. "It's all right, David. I'll get it." "Bring, bring," it opined again, but before I could stop him, David had picked up the handset and was answering. I rushed up, thumped him across the gob to stop him saying any more. "Who was that?" said my mother. "Oh, it was one of the painters," I said, knowing that she knew I was decorating my flat. "It sounded like one of the painters I've spoken to before." "Well, yes, it probably did a bit." "It's a bit late for a painter, isn't it?" "No, no, you just don't understand London, Mother. This is not like Leicester." For a whole year I'd lived in terror, an almost Thorpian terror of being found out for what I was. A poof. Fuck it, I thought. Why go through all this agony? I decided that I would invite my closest friends to a party to meet David and explain to them all that I was a bit bent. The agony of keeping silent had become too great. Having to explain to Marty, John and Tim that I had to rush off to St. Swithin's to cash a cheque when I should have been writing with them at 10 o'clock in the evening became boring, worrying and unnecessary. I thought, why hide something from intelligent people like that? I was ashamed that I wasn't admitting that Dave was my closest friend. He came to most of the recordings of the 1948 show and sat at the back anonymously in the audience and couldn't come with all the other people's wives and girlfriends to the bar after the recordings. So, after a year, I decided that this party would be a good idea to get it all out into the open once and for all. I invited Marty, John, Tim, Eric Idle, Barry Cryer, Dick Vosper and Beryl, almost everyone I knew. I don't think David Frost could make it. He was in a meeting at the time. And even my ex-girlfriend and one or two other people from St. Swithin's. This was a coming-out party. We laid on a very good meal in our little basement flat, a buffet. We had splendid food and lots to drink, because I still felt a bit nervous about the occasion, and I thought I'd better get everyone pretty pissed before making, well, not an announcement, just wandering from group to group, explaining that this was David and introducing him. And that's what I did. It was interesting seeing various people's reactions to this. From Marty, it wasn't so much surprise as disbelief, but then laughter. Being an East End lad brought up in a theatrical family with a telluric wife, he wasn't worried about it at all. John Cleese already knew about it because I thought that just to announce it to him, since he was one of my closest friends and we wrote together, would be tactless or even a form of betrayal. I'd actually told him about 2 nights before this party, so he wasn't surprised, but was still in a state of shock about it because it was totally, totally alien to him. Such a thing was unthinkable, and this was going to be the ruin of my life. Although he was still friendly, he was completely at a loss to give his feelings. But his girlfriend at the time, Pippa, was a lot more understanding. I've often found that women are a lot more understanding about male homosexuality than men. Because I suppose men feel threatened in some way. I don't know what it is, but your average butch male is probably worried about certain tendencies and things that went on at school, and now so bleeding butch and grimly heterosexual that he wouldn't admit to such a thing even existing, except with scorn or in various puny jokes about people wearing pink and mincing around. The other reactions. Barry Cryer was fine. He took it all in his stride because of his previous showbiz background. He did write for Danny LaRue, after all. My ex-girlfriend, unfortunately, ran off in tears, accompanied by a couple of people from St. Swithin's, so that was a bit of an unhappy moment, but she came to terms with it eventually. The other extraordinary reaction was from Eric Idle, who who was quite stunned. Obviously, he was quite young then, but I had to explain to him what it all meant, that I actually did go to bed with people of the same sex, and that it was quite fun and we actually loved each other. It wasn't at all naughty. Now, of course, he's probably even more liberated than I am. Not in the same way, but in 750 other ways. I felt a lot better after the party, but it was about 2 years later than that before I could tell my parents, which was a very difficult moment. It was a waste of my time pretending and a waste of their time worrying, so I told my mother that David was my boyfriend. I've never seen such rage, tears, stamping of little feet. It took me quite a long time to calm her down. Luckily, I was fortified on quite a lot of gin and tonic and was determined in my mind that everything was all right. I'd been in at the inception of the gay liberation movement in this country, and so had a pretty solid idea that what I was doing was not wrong, and that to love another human being of whatever sex is surely an admirable thing. I wasn't taking any more, and while she was having her little fit, I stood firm and told her to shut up, that it was all pointless. She had known David for a couple of years, and neither of us had done any harm to the other. Still, she screamed. Eventually she calmed down, and then I said, "Right, I'm going to tell Dad." That started her up again. "Oh, no, don't, it'll kill him." "It won't kill him, of course it won't kill him." "Yes, it will, it'll kill him. "Of course it won't, shut up, I'm going to tell him." But eventually she persuaded me that it might have some adverse effect on him and made me promise not to tell him. So they went home, my mother pretending that nothing had happened at all. She spent the next 7 nights completely sleepless until eventually my father forced it out of her and said, "Look, what the hell's the matter with you?" She explained to my father, who took it all in his stride. I was on my way back from some show I was doing in the north of England and was going to call in to see them in Leicester. I was too late, really, to call in and get back to London on time, so I rang them up from a motorway service station and explained that I couldn't call. At the end of the conversation, my father said, "Oh, Graham, your mother's been a bit upset this last week, and I know what it's about. Look, don't worry about it. She just doesn't understand these things." I felt fine. That was good. Thereafter, David has been like another son to them, and they've been absolutely splendid ever since. But it's very difficult for people to break that kind of news to their parents. They should. What's the point of hiding things and telling lies? Suddenly, I feel like digressing for another moment about morality. I intend to publish here for the first time what I believe to be a missing portion of the New Testament. The papyrus manuscript, translated here from the original Greek, was discovered in 1979 by the author at Auckland Airport. He was there, in transit to Sydney, Australia, on the 5th of November, whiling away a few moments, idly looking under rocks, when the manuscript was given to him by a Maori chieftain toilet attendant. The manuscript contained 2 leaves of an Alexandrian text type, similar to the Beatty Biblical Papyrus 2P46. But this was probably written by a scribe whose native tongue was Coptic. Once the misspellings and iticisms are corrected, it closely resembles the Greek of the earlier Alexandrian witnesses. The first epistle of Paul the Apostle to the New Zealanders, AD 59, chapter 1, in which Paul castigateth the Antipodeans, empty showing of holiness, of fornicators and abusers of mankind, of poverty and tolerance, exhorteth them to beware of false prophets. "Dear New Zealanders, it has come to my attention from our brother Hilary, the beekeeper of Auckland, that all is not well in your community. What is all this nonsense about certain of your number kneeling down in front of crosses? That is naughty in the extreme. You've changed the glory of an incorruptible God into an image. I understand that the very same people collect together in churches for the purpose of worship. Who needs it? God doesn't. I've asked him. He's fed up with it, especially the Psalms. They give him a headache and cause his teeth to strike together. Don't they realize their praise is meaningless? Why can't they concentrate on being better behaved towards one another and forget about this empty show of holiness? He says, though don't quote me on this, they can stuff it up their asses. He said that, not I. I, a mere mortal, would not have put it quite like that. I'm afraid I think too much about my earthly reputation, but I cannot help agreeing with him. About fornicators, adulterers, effeminates, and abusers of mankind, I'm constantly being misquoted on this point. I would like to state quite clearly that sex is nothing more than a way in which 2 or more people can have lots of harmless cheap fun, provided that they are clean and that the aim is not reproduction. The betterment of the lot of mankind is impossible without strict limits on reproduction, so don't make the mistake the rest of the world has made and overpopulate yourselves. Not everyone has to have children for Christ's sake. He didn't have any, and I should know. If you really feel you have to have children, then make sure that as parents you have no more than you can properly look after. I don't know how all this nonsense about counting souls got started. It just leads to overcrowding and poverty. Look, poverty isn't all it's cracked up to be. I think the old needle, rich man, camel story is being misunderstood out of context. Of course, worrying about earthly possessions makes it difficult to concentrate on spiritual things, but, dear friends, isn't it also difficult to concentrate on spiritual things if you're an ill-nourished, diseased down-and-out? The deprived may also become the depraved. I've had a lot of trouble with this poverty idea in Rome, where the notion unfortunately seems to be catching on that the church should be richer than anyone else on the grounds that only they can handle it. Peter, for instance, scared Ananias and Sapphira to death for hard cash in the name of the church. I said to him, "Now that wasn't very Christ-like, was it?" And he told me to get stuffed, as he was a super-apostle. You seem to have made more progress in stamping out the primitive tribal mutilation of circumcision than they have in the more venal communities, yet it is still recommended, so the beekeeper tells me, by some wretched physicians who seek to line their pockets or cling to their Judaic ancestry. Talking of tribes, from what I've heard, there could still be more understanding and tolerance between the two main tribes in your islands. I hope this is heeded more than my letter to the Tasmanians. I exhort you to be empathetic. Be splendid. Be aware of your own ignorance. And, as always, beware of those who claim to lead you to better self-knowledge by taking your money. Must finish now, as I have to catch the post. Lots of love. P. Kiss, kiss, kiss.